assembling the weapon. All of this was merely misdirection. He was not going to use the rifle, not going to snipe anyone today. This was all aimed at encouraging Sidorenko to believe the story that his top assassin had been compromised somehow and captured or killed outright by CIA assassins. When Abood turned up alive, his shackled form on television from The Hague, Sid would wonder what happened to the hitman he'd sent to kill him. Carmichael had promised that Langley would let it be known that a SAD paramilitary operations team had finally caught up with their most wanted man, killed him dead on the coast of the Red Sea, just moments before he killed again. Court had no way of knowing for sure if this ruse would work. Sid was no fool, but, Gentry decided, the more evidence he could plant on site that would indicate that he was, in fact, in place for the Abood hit, the more likely Sidorenko and his people would get word that the leaked story matched with the physical traces of Gray's last known location. So the American took his time, laid out the scene exactly as he would if the sniping, in fact, were about to take place. The rifle was placed in position on its bipod, the scope cap was unsnapped, and the optics were ranged properly for a 400-meter shot in negligible winds. The gun was loaded, and extra cartridges were lined up neatly on his right-hand side. Finally, when he was satisfied with his ruse, Court took one last look at his sniper's hide. How easy it would have been for him to assassinate President Abood, make his way to a speedboat at the far edge of the island, shoot hard and fast over the gentle Red Sea waters to an awaiting larger craft, and then churn away into international waters. Sure, the Sudanese had gunboats. He might get unlucky and run into one during his escape. But the odds of avoiding the Sudanese Navy were likely a hell of a lot better than they were for the success of Nocturne Sapphire. Court shook his head slowly. A shitload of things beyond Court's control needed to go very, very right in the next few hours. Gentry backed down the stairs. Out again on the pre-dawn dirt roads of Old Swakin Island, he backed his way the 3 blocks to the water's edge, ensuring that no tracks of one man coming and going were anywhere to be found. He hefted his much lighter pack and stepped back into the warm water. It was as placid as a swimming pool, though the brackish smell left little doubt that it was not chemically cleansed. When he was neck deep, holding on to his floating pack with both hands, he looked back at the island. When his planted evidence was found, whether in hours or in days, he would be linked to the scene. It would appear to everyone that the assassin had made it to his sniper's nest, set it up as per his requirements, and then lain in wait for his prey. And then it would appear to everyone as if the sniper just simply vanished into thin air. The gray man smiled darkly as he turned, gently kicked his feet, and began floating towards the shoreline 100 meters away. There wasn't a soul on the dirt streets of New Swakin at 5 in the morning. First light was not for another hour. Oryx would not pass by for 90 minutes. But Court was already in position, tucked deep into shadows at the long, tin-roofed fish market that composed the southeastern corner of the square. With him was his CIA backpack, nearly 50 pounds of gear stowed inside. His satellite phone was attached to the left side of his belt under his loose-fitting shirt, wired into the C4 Ops radio hooked alongside it. The wireless earpieces were tucked in both ears, and the thin rubber and wire tube lay flat on his cheek as it snaked down to his mouth, allowing the covert headset to be nearly invisible in the hair on his head and of his beard. Under his shirt on his belt, he carried his suppressed Glock 19 and 2 extra magazines. 46 rounds of 9mm ammunition in total. Not a lot for a battle, but this morning's action was supposed to go on around him and not on top of him. Still, he sure as hell would have liked some more firepower. Court took his time to tune himself into his environment. Loose camels roamed the streets. Donkeys were in corrals or tied to wooden hitching posts. The town around him looked, quite literally, like something from biblical times, with the one big exception being the old crumbling mosque in front of him. There were no mosques here in the time of Christ, but surely this particular view that he had, sitting at the open-air fishmonger's stall, must not have changed one iota since the 12th century. He imagined himself back in those days and wondered if some spy or assassin had crouched at this very place at this very time of morning, with nefarious designs on a target in that mosque or in that ancient-looking building across the square. Only then did he notice the few anachronisms in the scene. Several donkey carts were in view, but all had thick rubber tires instead of ancient wooden cartwheels. Much of the metal roofing and siding of the shacks in view were rusted oil drums or even large tin coffee cans. A broken blue plastic bucket hung from a rope outside a second-story window. Without warning, a voice spoke close. It startled him, and he grabbed for his pistol and rose, bumping his head on a loose wooden shelf above him in the shack, before recognizing that the voice was Zack and that it had come through his headset. He knelt back down, mad at himself.
"Good morning, Six, wherever you are. Me and the boys are just finishing up our second cup of coffee. Then we'll get geared up and head to shore."
The sound of a long stretch and a sigh. Obvious dramatic effect.
"Damn, sure as shit is nice working for the man. Not running rogue, sitting scared by yourself in the dark somewhere, hoping like hell that rat running up your leg doesn't bite you in the balls because you can't afford to move and give away your position."
Court looked down. There was no rat on his leg. He chastised himself for looking.
"Pretty soon, bro, you'll be back working with us. Of course, you'll still be the outsider, but I promise I'll let you join us for a cup of joe from time to time."
Gentry nodded. It would be good to be part of a team again, even if there were a few caveats to the relationship.
"First things first, though. Let's get through this morning. One out."
"Roger that," whispered Court to himself. He did not transmit to Hightower. He rose slowly, avoided the shelf above, and crossed the tiny alleyway towards the side entrance to the bank. He picked the lock in under 30 seconds. It was a simple tumbler job that needed just two narrow tools and a few jiggles of the torque wrench to defeat. Inside, it was pitch black. Stale dust wafted in the moonlight, shining through circular and arched windows. Court pulled his penlight from his pocket and turned it on, put it in his mouth, and crossed down a small colonnade that ran along the eastern side of the large, open building. This place had been around for hundreds of years, Gentry could tell, but apparently banking was no longer such a big deal in Swakin. Most of the space was open and empty, with a few desks and telephones, wooden filing cabinets, and steps that went down to a basement. Court continued on to the main entrance and found it exactly as drawn up in the diagrams Zack had provided him. There were stairs to the left and the right of the front double doors. The steps went up to a narrow atrium over the doors, where large windows looked out over the square. Gentry took a few minutes to stage his gear, hustling a half dozen times up and down the spiral stone staircases to position equipment where he would need it when Oryx and his security detail came storming through the door, thinking they were saving themselves from an attack in the square. Court looked out the open windows of the atrium, getting a good look at the square for the first time. It did not look like a square, in the sense that Court knew the word from his travels in Europe, Asia, and Latin America. It was the size of two football fields, completely unpaved, not a blade of grass, just a big, flat expanse of hard earth. On the opposite side of the bank were some rickety-looking two-story buildings, whitewashed colonial-style architecture, but dingy, their filth obvious even in the moonlight shine. To the northeast, the right side of the square, it was nothing but shacks, handmade driftwood, plywood, tin, and junk hammered together or tied together, or, Court imagined with slight exaggeration, simply leaned together with a prayer to Allah and a hope for the best. The shacks stretched down a hill several blocks to the water's edge and the causeway to the island of Old Swakin. To the left of Court's vantage point, the western side of the square, he saw the finest building Swakin had to offer. The hotel was there, the Swakin Palace. Court looked at the third floor and wondered if Sierra 5 was watching. Gentry stood in pitch blackness inside the bank, but he figured Spencer would have night vision gear of some sort. He raised his hand tentatively.
"Sierra 5 to Sierra 1.
The transmission came over the net a second later.
"Go for 1,
Zack's tinny voice responded.
"Sierra 6 is in position."
"Never a doubt in my mind," said Hightower.
Court lowered his hand. It felt odd to be watched, especially at a time like this. He continued scanning the rest of the buildings of the square. They were whitewashed limestone and coral, looking as old as Methuselah, Gentry thought. Then he wondered if Methuselah was from around here. He eyed the street from where the SLA trucks should come, assuming they'd come at all. If they did not, then Cort assumed he'd leave all his gear here and just scoot on out the side door of the bank. The Sudanese would find a curious array of gadgets lying around the building where their president was set to come if there was a ruckus. But the CIA would not be positively implicated in any sort of attack or potential ambush. All of this gear was available outside of the USA, and all of this gear had been procured outside of the USA. But the CIA local field office, Sudan Station, had assured everyone involved in no uncertain terms that their rebels would come through. Everyone involved had believed them, to the extent that Court's source was discounted as unreliable for providing intel that said otherwise. Fuck, thought Court. This is not how he operated his solo hits. Everything was so much simpler as a private contract killer. Chapter 33. The gray man had finished his work inside the bank by 6:10. He'd just returned to his perch on the second floor when a transmission from Zack came through. Whiskey Sierra in position. 3 is on a rooftop on the northwest corner of the square. 5 is in the third floor window of the Swakin Palace on the southwest corner. The remainder of us are together and mobile, 3 blocks northeast of the square. We are in a beige... break. What the hell is this piece of shit? A beige Ford Econoline van. The SLA will hit from the west. They should be getting into position right about now. First one that sees or hears any sign of them, call it in. A staccato pair of Roger That's from his men at the square followed the transmission. Dawn began in the east 10 minutes later. The town sloped from the square down to the water, so from his second floor vantage point, Court could see the distant sea glowing with morning light where it met the sky. Oryx would appear on the other side of the square in minutes, yet still no one had seen any sign of the SLA. They should at least have been somewhere staging to move, and the 2 Whiskey Sierra operators west of the square should have either heard or seen them by now. But there was nothing. Gentry saw what Zack meant when he said the town had an old west feel. Looking out of the window at the dirt, the simple buildings, the hitching posts and water troughs, the donkey carts and wooden awnings, guns at the ready for a shootout, Court realized he could be in another world and another time. Gentry sipped water in his high perch. He checked the layout of items in the pack on his back for the 4th time. Tension built quickly in his stomach.
1 for 5, Zack said in his mic. Go for 5-1, replied Spencer, the muscular black team member who had been an Army Special Forces sergeant before moving into CIA Black Ops. Still nothing in your sector? Don't see anything over here by the hotel. 3?
Not a peep to the northwest, boss.
Hesitation from Hightower. Court wondered if he was about to abort the mission.
All right, looks like we're gonna have to go ahead with Bravo.
In the dark atrium of the bank, Court Gentry's eyebrows furrowed almost to the point of touching. What the hell was Bravo? If there was a plan B, then Court sure as shit hadn't been read in on it.
Roger that, boss, said 3. I've got the RPG ready.
The RPG? Cold sweat formed on the gray man's temples. Court began to reach down to push a button on his sat phone to call Zack to find out what the hell was going on, but he didn't have to.
Okay, 6, let me fill you in before you blow a blood vessel.
Zack's disembodied voice sounded somewhat contrite.
Denny and I were worried that the SLA might not be able to come through for us. Sudan Station kept promising, but you saw how their numbers were diminishing before our eyes. Your source, the cop, and his intel that the SLA had been compromised, pretty much sealed the deal. Brother, even without the SLA, we are still going to go ahead. You don't need a battle. You just need a diversion, a little attack to get Oryx moving to his security team's rally point. Well, 6, we're gonna give you that little attack, aren't we, 3?
Roger that, 1.
3 and 5 are going to lay down some direct fire, just enough to get Oryx and his close-in bodyguards through the door of the bank. Then we're going to hit the remainder of the guys in the square from the northeast, just to keep their heads down for a minute or two. After that, you'll be clear. Break.
There was a long pause.
This is Denny's plan, by the way. I didn't want to tell you before now because, well, shit, I hope the SLA would show. Hope you're not too pissed.
Court wasn't pissed. He was white-hot fucking livid. 100 rebels had turned to zero, and Zack had neglected to mention the company of infantry that was supposed to be in the area. Court had thought that he would have plenty of time to get Oryx to the car and out of town while the bodyguards were fighting it out with rebels. But now, he only had the support of 5 men in the square, and they would break contact almost immediately, giving Court virtually no time to get Oryx out of the bank, move him 10 blocks to the car, and then get him on the road and out of town. Court had been ordered not to transmit on the C4 Ops radio, but he did not care. He pressed the talk button on his belt.
You son of a bitch, I can't get him out in time!
Off the net, Six, Zack ordered.
As team leader, his radio had been set to override the transmissions of all others.
Oryx and his detail are inside. They are entering the square northeast corner. Get ready to hit the rear of the party, Three.
Three has targets in sight, said Dan, his voice low.
Court looked out the window at the dawn. He could just make out movement, the mass of dark-suited men in the distance, appearing in the square. He looked down at the staircase, thought about running, although he didn't really know where he would go. It was too late to continue on with Sid's operation now. There was no way he could get back to the Blazer rifle and shoot Abood, and if he did not complete that objective, then Sidorenko would not help him get out of the country. Conversely, if he did not go through with Nocturne Sapphire, Zack and the CIA would not help him get out of the country either. He was stuck, past the point of no return, and this was the reason Hightower hadn't told him of the change in the mission to direct action. He'd have to continue on with Nocturne Sapphire now.
200 yards to the bank, said Five. I'll hit them when they're passing by the door.
Roger that.
Gentry took one last look at his gear around him on the atrium. It was all in place. He calmed himself. This was different from most of his other operations, but they'd snagged some terrorists back in the Goon Squad days, so Court was no stranger to this sort of action. Still, this was big. This was the biggest, most complicated, most time-sensitive mission he'd ever been on. It was a mission that stank of desperation on the part of the CIA. Court's mentor, Maurice, had always told him,
"Any mission you can't afford to walk away from is a mission you should run away from."
150 yards, came the call from Sierra 5.
Maurice had another saying that popped into Court's mind right then.
A plan is just a big list of shit that's not going to happen.
Court had found this to be the one constant in his missions, in his life. Plans were good, plans were necessary, but ultimately, most plans were bullshit.
Sierra 3-1.
Go for one.
Boss, I got a truck passing below my position.
SLA?
Court could hear the hopefulness in Hightower's voice.
Wait one, break.
A short pause.
Then?
Negative. It's GOS troops.
5-1. I got troops over here too. 2 blocks west of me heading towards the square.
God damn it, said Zack as way of reply. Shit, thought Court. The GOS was nearby, but the SLA was not. Who were the GOS looking for? Court squinted across the square. To his right, the sun began to rise over the water like a fresh red blister. Dawn's light gave an eerie glow to the whitewashed buildings to his left. Abood's entourage, some 20 or more men, closed on his position.
One, this is Three. What we doing, boss?
Court's earpiece was alive with Whiskey Sierra's traffic, though he was under orders not to transmit himself. Court whispered to himself in the cool, dark atrium, willing with every ounce of imagined magic projection he could muster.
Abort, abort.
He stayed at the window, but he was ready to run down the stairs and out the back door of the building. He could get away, not to the car left for him, but to the water. There were little boats tied up all around the harbor. He could grab one and go. Hightower's voice came over the net. Court knew each inflection of the man, to where he could hear the stress concealed between the words.
Say number of tangos, over.
1-3. Could be about 30. 3-0, break. 1 long flatbed. Small arms and RPGs sighted, break. Might be some PKMs in there too, boss, over.
PKMs were big Russian belt-fed machine guns.
Roger that, said Zack flatly.
5-1. I've got about the same number over here. They're patrolling in columns. Doesn't look like they're too jacked up for trouble.
When Zack said nothing else for a few seconds, the net crackled to life again.
1, this is 3. I can engage right now. Once they disperse, it's going to be hard.
Understood, 3. Wait 1,
said Zack.
Abort,
whispered Gentry again, and then again under his breath, he said over and over and over a line that he'd used many times in the past when life and death was all up to Sierra One, and court was on the tip of the spear awaiting the decision.
Be cool, Zack. Be cool, Zack. Be cool, Zack.
Court knew everything, literally, his very life, likely depended on Sierra One's next transmission. A safe, quiet exfiltration, and then an investigation into how Nocturne Sapphire fell apart so completely. Or the alternative, World War fucking 3.
Be cool, Zack.